And Rob basically takes our business plan, freaking crumples it up in front of our faces, leans over and drops it in the trash can and goes, you guys should not do this. Do not raise money from anyone. You're going to lose everyone's money.
Hey guys, welcome to the Navigate Podcast. We are strategic navigators and we save entrepreneurs 40 to 60% on their income taxes. We're your hosts, Adam Dirksen.
I'm Mitch Salanti, and today on the podcast, we have Mikey Taylor, who is a former professional skateboarder, co-founder of St. Archer Brewery, which he sold to Miller Coors for $35 million, co-founder of Commune Capital, a real estate investment group, as well as a Thousand Oaks City Council member. Welcome to the podcast. We're going to just allow you to introduce yourself a little bit and share your background.
Okay, first off, thanks for having me. My name is Mikey Taylor. My background, I started as a skateboarder. My first career, I actually became a professional skateboarder, which was a very fun 14 years. From there, I started my first business after my career ended, which was in the craft beer industry. I started a company called St. Archer down in San Diego. And we were really successful with that business. It took off from the second we opened doors, which is not normal. And then we ended up selling our business in 2015 to Miller Coors. And then from there, I started my current business, which is a private equity real estate firm. We build apartment buildings. We build storage units. And I'm also a council member for the city of Thousand Oaks. That's right. And then I'm married and I have four kids now.
Love it. So you don't have too much going on.
I'm tired. I'm tired. There's a lot going on. Yeah.
Let's start with skateboarding. We said right before we started recording, I used to skateboard as a kid. I stopped at like age 11 or 12, but came in third place in the John Shepherd skate contest in Lake Bluff, Illinois. So I got a little bit of something in my name. Not quite That's as much. Right. I didn't have my own DC shoe line, but talk to us a little bit about that and that journey. Growing up in Thousand Oaks and, how that all even happened.
Yeah. So I picked up a skateboard for probably the same reason you picked up a skateboard or anyone else. I just saw other people doing it. It looked fun. And I don't know, there's something about skating that just kind of grabbed me, which was actually common for a lot of the things I did. Anytime I got into something, I kind of became obsessed with it. The only difference with skating is it never let up. You know, like I normally would get into, let's say, biking, and I'd be obsessed with it, and I'd do it for like a year, and then I'd be bored. And then I would get into playing hockey, and then I would, you know, all these other things. Just the lifespan of my attention, it waned over time. Skateboarding, it just never stopped. It was different. It was a different experience. And because of that, I went 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old. I'm still skateboarding. And I started getting into the age of needing to make some money. So instead of quitting skateboarding and, you know, working a job, I made a bunch of videos of me skateboarding and sent it out to all these companies. And I had a handful of companies start sending me free product. They started flowing me, is what it's called. And then I started selling a portion of that product to local skaters so I could make some money. So that was like my first hustle. And then I had the opportunity to start traveling with some of those sponsors, and then I later went pro with them. And then that led to kind of what you talked about. I started having my own skateboard line, my own clothing line, my own shoe line, and it turned into like a real career. It was crazy.
What age did it click when it's like, okay, I can make a career out of this, and my parents can calm down a little bit? Because I think I read something that your parents weren't stoked you weren't going to college.
Yeah. Me telling my parents I wasn't going to college was not a fun combo. They were not stoked on that. It took a couple years. So when I first decided to basically not go to school and start skating, I was making a little bit amount of money, $800 a month. And then I got to the point where I was making a couple grand and I was like, yeah, this is sick, but like, I can't like really do it like this. And then it wasn't until like my fourth year where I started making like, I think I was making like 80 grand a year, 90 grand a year. And I was like, dang, maybe there's something here. And at that point, my parents kind of eased up. And then I like got to a point where I started making like more money than my parents. And they were like, this is crazy. Keep doing this. Like they totally, you know, started encouraging me with it, you know?
Yeah. Where was most of the money coming from? Was it sponsors mostly, contests, like a mix of both?
Yeah, the majority of it was sponsors for me. So I had a skateboard sponsor, a clothing sponsor, and a shoe sponsor that paid me every month to be able to use my name. Okay. So I had, it's typically a anywhere from a 2 to 3 year contract. Gotcha. And then when you have your own line, like when you have your own skateboards or your own shoes, you start getting a royalty for every shoe or skateboard sold.
Yep.
So my income was a split from my basically minimum, and then I got a royalty for everything I sold above the minimum, or let's call it like an advanced draw almost.
Gotcha. Pretty early on, you're pretty wise about what to do with your money. I read that you were living off of $20,000 a year.
And yeah, I was
throwing the rest into real estate or investing it. So, I mean, that's, first of all, that's rare, because the reputation that skateboarders get is you're basically a punk. Like, you're not smart. You're not going to be successful. I remember skating home after that skateboard competition I told you about, and some teenagers rolled their window down their car and they're like, "You're an idiot. Like, you'll never be successful." You got way more of that, I know, than I ever would have. But talk a little bit about, you started to be really wise with your money, and obviously you're successful now.
So the thing about, it's not just skaters. Like, I'm with you on like the reputation that skaters have, but it's really athletes. Like, if you have somebody that's willing to go through, you know, the 10,000 plus hours to become like the best at something, that's a very obsessive personality. And that's somebody who does really well with discipline, right? Skaters follow that mold completely, because learning how to skateboard is so difficult. It takes so much time to get there that if you master it, you are somebody that does well with discipline is the only way to say it. Like, you do possess that skill. And so for me back then, that's what the whole money kind of thing was. It wasn't that I was like overly bright or, you know, had a lot of wisdom around money. It's that I had somebody come into my life and say, "Dude, you need to think about your money. This is what you should do." And once he gave me the framework, the discipline kicked over. And that's where I basically was living like I was absolutely broke and was good with it. It wasn't even hard for me to do that.
Yeah.
So the beginning stages, it was discipline that really, I think, led to the success of at least how I was investing. And then I started learning along the way. But I would say the first 5 years, I didn't know anything. I was just like, "What should I do? Okay, I'll do it." And I just had great guidance through those early stages.
Right. To your point about discipline and skateboarding, I think something that's unique that this just came into my head right now. Adam and I both played sports. He ran track in college. I played lacrosse in college. But something that's unique about skateboarding is that as you progress, there are like real tangible things that happen versus like in lacrosse, like maybe you just like your stick skills get better, but that's not like tangible in the sense that like you couldn't kickflip yesterday and you can do a kickflip or a tray flip now.
Yeah.
Things like that. So I think that's something unique that skaters have too. And obviously in what you do now, you're very focused on meeting tangible goals. And
Right.
Yeah,
that's true. That's unique. Yeah, it's a really good point. It totally is. Yeah, you get to feel the reward of the time you put in when you learn a new trick.
Yeah.
Where I played hockey before I skated, and I totally get it. Like, it's not like I like all of a sudden one day learned like a slap shot. I was like, yeah, I just got better at the thing I already knew how to do. You know?
You played hockey growing up in Thousand Oaks.
Yeah, I played on a travel ice team, actually.
Let's go. That's
yeah, I used awesome. To go back east for summer camp at Pennsylvania, and yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up playing too. I grew up in the Chicago area, so it's a little more common. So
yeah. Oh yeah.
Go Blackhawks. Yeah,
Thousand Oaks, not as big.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about when you started St. Archer Brewery in 2012. Mm-hmm. I just read that you did that with P-Rod among some other guys, which was cool to read. I mean, like Ryan Sheckler was the guy that I think everyone in kind of my demographic was kind of grew up looking towards Ryan Sheckler, but P-Rod started beating him because he was doing everything switch. But anyway, that was cool to read that you went in with him. But talk a little bit about that process and going from skateboarder to entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And also I want you to share specifically what Rob Dyrdek said to you and your group, because you shared a little bit about that in AT.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple things. One, Paul Rodriguez, for anybody who doesn't know, is basically the Tiger Woods of skateboarding and Kobe Bryant of skateboarding. He's like truly the GOAT. And he was also one of my best friends growing up before we were ever sponsored. So him and I have been close for a long time now. Him, myself, and another guy, Josh Landon, we were the three partners that started St. Archer. And in the beginning, we just had this idea that we knew how to market brands. And if we could come up with a new product that didn't exist inside of our industry, that we'd be able to create enough waves and a big enough splash that it could be relevant. And, you know, we might be able to actually build something significant if it was something that had never been done. And so, you know, we started talking about what type of product that could be. And really, like, to give you more context, in skateboarding and surfing and snowboarding, you always see the same new businesses come out. It's always like a new skate company, a new clothing brand, a new hat business, but it's always the same niche. And at that time, energy drinks were like kind of pumping. It was like Monster and Red Bull and Rockstar started infiltrating our space. And we didn't think energy drinks were cool, but we knew that like beverage had the opportunity to go so much further than the skate industry. And so we basically started talking about beer. Like, what would it be like if we did a brewery and had like skaters and surfers and snowboarders involved and we marketed it the same way we market skate product? Like, maybe that could be cool. And so we basically started a business. We didn't know anything. We didn't have enough money to start it. So we had to build a business plan. We had to go out and raise money. And then we finally opened doors in 2012. And I think there was about 9 of us total when we started it. And then by the time we sold, we had almost like 55 employees. That's significant. So it was cool. Yeah, it was a little bit of a it was our college. Like, we learned business through that experience. Oh, yeah.
I believe it. Can you share the pitch story a little bit?
Oh, about Rob Dyrdek?
Yeah, with Rob, because I remember, I'm not going to spoil it. I'm going to let you say it, but I love that part.
Okay, so Rob Dyrdek was one of the first pros I had ever met. I lived in this area, Newbury Park, and one of my close friends was like really good at skating. So all these pros would come out to see him. And I was his boy, so I would always, you know, meet these guys as well. Rob, I met when I was 16. I remember very vividly that he would always make fun of me for the clothes I would wear, right? Like, look, this pro's making fun of me over and over. But we eventually became friends. Rob was the person who put out my first pro model skateboard. Rob was very influential in my skate career. He mentored me from basically the point of him turning me pro towards the almost end of my career.
Wow.
And, you know, what we did is we watched him go from being a pro skateboarder to a reality star, to creating a venture fund, to selling businesses. Like, you know, we were paying attention to what he did outside of skateboarding. And so when we came up with our idea of launching our first business, he was the first person that we reached out to. And it wasn't just like, hey, we got to pitch Rob. I was so excited to pitch Rob. Like, yeah. I thought it was going to be one of those moments where, like, your mentor looks at you and goes, I'm so proud of you. You can do this. Here's some money, right? That's not what happened at all. We basically pitched him. And Rob could be a little bit overdramatic. And Rob basically takes our business plan, freaking crumples it up in front of our faces, leans over and drops it in the trash can and goes, you guys should not do this. Do not raise money from anyone. You're going to lose everyone's money. Like, he just thought we were going to fail miserably. Now, where I'm going to give him some grace, in the beer space, in craft beer, like, no one did any type of marketing. Like, there was no true brand. It was all product that sold, right? So, like, somebody would go into the store, they'd look at the beer aisle, there'd be some new bottle that they had never seen before, and they'd try it. That was all their marketing. So when we told Rob that no one did this and we were going to introduce the way we market and actually build a brand, he thought we had not done our due diligence, because he thought there was no way in 2012 that any business could be successful with zero marketing. He was like, there's no way that exists. And it was true. Like, the beer industry was just behind the eight ball when it came to marketing. And so we were really successful, and he was one of the first people to call us when we sold and tell us how proud of us he was. And, you know, he's so glad he was wrong. I mean, he's great. I love him now. He's been huge in my life. I'm very thankful for him.
Full circle. I was going to ask what you said to him when he, although I didn't just say no, he's like, you're going to lose everyone's money, and then goes through like, yeah, crumples the paper.
Yeah.
What'd you say?
You know what though?
What'd you say to him?
It's hard because like knowing what I know now, most people that do start businesses fail. Like your first business is very difficult to do, especially when you have zero experience. And to have to raise money with your first business with no experience, like knowing what I know now, I don't know if I would give money to someone in that position. Like it's almost like you start to learn too much, and you the type of due diligence you do changes as you have more experience, more wisdom. So I don't even fault him for it. In some way, I think it motivated us to like prove him wrong, you know?
Yeah. But, I know you're probably hesitant to say it on the podcast, but I know what one of your friends said to him at the end of that pitch. You mentioned it at AT, but did he invest? Did he get a piece of that $35 million exit, or was it?
He did not. He did not. Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah. He did not. Awesome. Yeah.
Okay. So you made the exit, and then in 2018, you started Commune Capital. So talk a little bit about that process. Why that direction? You just did, you started a brewer, like something very creative and unique. Why go into something so practical?
Yeah, good question. So we had a model that we used to build St. Archer that was, it was a little bit ahead of its time. Now it's a little bit more obvious, but we were doing ambassador marketing and kind of storytelling and building the brand around our investors through social media in order to sell the product, right? And I knew we had something that worked. What I was scared of doing after we sold St. Archer was trying to do the same thing in the same industry that had already seen that before. So part of my thought process when I was trying to figure out what was next was what industry is like craft beer in the sense of they're behind the eight ball. They don't understand marketing. It's stale. It's not current. Like, where could I apply this model that would separate me from everyone else? So that was the first thing I was looking for. The second part was I started having skaters call me after my career ended and were asking me how I did what I did financially. Like, how did you get out of the skateboard industry and start a business? How are you in a position now where you're not working and you're fine? Like, how do we do that? And after I started getting enough of those calls, I started thinking about what I thought a new opportunity could be, which was replicate the guy who came into my life when I was 19, who helped me build the foundation, taught me how to build my credit, build a budget, build an investment plan, start investing. And then even when it led to real estate, like I started getting real estate opportunities through him as well. So I kind of felt like I could create a business that educated people, empowered people, and then had an investment vehicle for people that wanted to invest in the things I had my money in. And then I could apply, you know, this marketing aspect that we use with St. Archer into this new business. And I just landed on real estate because I wanted to bring an investment to, at that time, athletes who could put their money into something, who could get cash flow, because, you know, we're trying to figure out how to make money once our sponsors run out. So cash flow is important. But I also wanted them to be able to build wealth because they're at a young age, and to just focus on cash flow in your 20s is kind of, I don't think that's that smart. But this offered both. And I liked the risk element of it. Like, there wasn't great risk in this in comparison to some of the other stuff that I was investing in, or even St. Archer. And so I landed on multifamily apartments. I'm going to build an investment firm. I'm going to build multifamily apartments. I'm going to allow people to invest with me. And all of our marketing on social media is going to be educational and teaching people how to do this. And then we just went for it.
It wasn't an easy journey. I was watching a video earlier today about when you started it, and the comments were brutal.
Yeah.
People were ruthless. I can't even say it. The first one made me laugh, but it was ruthless, I can't say it on here.
Yeah. This one was commune capital is the most complex, hardest business I have ever done. And I think private equity is just by nature very difficult.
Yeah.
On top of that, I had to transition an entire identity and platform along with that. So there was, I got hit on both ends, just a hard business that has a very high barrier to entry and, you know, creating content that most people that follow me didn't want to see. So it was, I got double whammied on it.
What were some of the challenges in 2018 when you got started, and how have those shifted to today now in 2024 when you're over 5 years into it?
Yeah. The first thing I noticed was I expected it to be easier to raise money for real estate than it was for the brewery. Like when we started the brewery,
I would think so too.
Yeah. I wasn't prepared for it being hard on that regard. Like I went in going, you have three kids that knew nothing about beer, had no business experience, it was about $8 million total by the time we were done with it. That was brutal. Now, like I know how to do business. I've been investing in real estate a long time. Like this should be a no-brainer. And what I wasn't prepared for was it's easier to sell a dream that has a shitload of risk tied with it than it is to sell an investment that is de-risked, but the upside is limited, right? Mm-hmm. Selling a 15% annualized IRR in a much safer investment is actually more difficult than selling, I can 12x your money, but the reality is I'm probably going to lose your money. Like that ends up being the easier.
Too boring and safe.
Yeah, I was not ready for that one. So it was harder to raise money in the beginning than I was anticipating. But now it's like the amount of money we raise, like, you know, for context, we raised $2.5 million when we started St. Archer.
Yeah.
It took us, 7 months to raise it. And I wasn't sure we were going to raise $1 million. Right now, like my partner just came in here. He's like, dude, we raised almost $1 million this week. Like it's the amount of money we raise now is not even comparable, but getting started doing this was much harder than I thought.
Yeah. Gotcha. All right. So what are some of the challenges today now?
Oh, okay. So there's challenges for the moment we're in, and then there's just challenges to raising money in general. I would say probably the challenge to raising money in the moment is more the debt market. Like, you know, when the Fed increased interest rates the way they did, a lot of lenders pulled out and it's just become harder to finance deals. So that's probably the challenge of right now. The things that are hard about raising money, I would say when you're raising money, you put the majority of your focus on the pitch, right? Like, how do I meet people and how do I nail my presentation? But the magic is all actually in the follow-up. It's how you follow up and how consistent you are and the type of things you're saying in the follow-up. That's where it happens. And so it's easy to forget that. So I would say if you are somebody who's raising money, don't neglect the follow-up. If you are somebody who is going to step out to raise money, I'm telling you, without a follow-up, you won't raise money regardless of how amazing your pitch is.
Yeah. That's a good word.
Yeah. So it just gets hard when you start dealing with a lot of investors. Like, you know, I think we have like 300 investors right now in our current pipeline that our team is calling. And so having to follow up with that many people, considering there's going to be times where people don't respond and the tracking of it, it gets harder as you attempt to scale it. And that follow-up is so important. So it's just, it takes a lot of energy that goes there.
What level are these 300 at? Like, what's your minimum and what are people kind of getting up to?
Yeah, that's a good question. Our minimum investment is $100,000. You have to be an accredited investor. So there is a hurdle to get past. And then in that group, it's basically, there's, I think, four categories. There's you know, 0 to 50,000, even though our minimum is 100,000, there's people that will enter in that they're interested in investing less than that. They're still entered in. We still are going to have a touch point with them. Okay. Then you have 100 to 200, you have 200 to 250, and then you have 250 plus. And I would say where the average is, I don't know, probably averages out somewhere around 200 when it's all said and done.
Gotcha. Okay. What do you expect the future to look like? I imagine you want to keep doing this for a while. You're obviously super passionate about it. You're helping people. So how does this change? How does it grow?
For my business, Commune specifically?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we have a, right now we're managing about $250 million of commercial real estate. Our next goal, at least for management, is we want to be managing $1 billion. We have the goal of doing it within 5. I really want to do it within 3. So my goal is 3. The team's goal is 5. If we don't do anything, we just keep doing what we're doing right now, we'll get there in about 10. From a, you know, building the business standpoint, we are all still wearing multiple hats. Even though we've been in business now like 8 years, there's still times where we're doing things that, you know, if we were bigger, we wouldn't. We would just be really honed in on one kind of individual lane. I'm looking forward to getting it to that point. I think we're probably a year out to where it's just like everybody is very focused on their highest calling. There's no really bleed over. And then I would say in the next 3 years, I would like to get to the point where this thing is running completely without me. Not saying I'm not going to work here, but I think if you can't build a business that has the option to run without you, you're not building a business correctly. And I'm not at that option yet. So that's kind of one of my secondary goals as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think more founders need to have that outlook because a lot of them are just tied to their business. And Adam, I'll let you ask a question. I've been asking.
Yeah. I had a couple questions stored up here, but I didn't want to derail, but
go for it.
I want to talk a little bit about your content. I'm a new follower. I was looking at a bunch of your videos on Instagram. I love them. And one thing that I've learned just from hearing you talk, Mikey, is that your coachability, you have that factor about you. I think that's one reason why you're probably so successful. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a big part of success is bringing people in. And I learned a while ago that the best way to do that is to build people up around you. So yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. And going along with that, just looking at a bunch of your videos here, you're trying to help people and you're trying to help people with their finances and you're looking for those people who are coachable and your content is very value add for, I'm just a couple of the titles here, like renting versus buying or mortgaging or you know, how much money do renters need to afford a certain size apartment? That's your space. That's your gift. That's like you mentioned, your calling. You're very good at that. And I hope more people grasp that and catch on to your content there because you're going to help a lot of people with that.
Thank you. I feel like that's kind of one of the purposes of the business. And I enjoy it. Like I am thankful that I had that person in my life. And I've now been able to realize the reward of that. Mm-hmm. And I want as many people to experience that as possible, you know?
Mikey, I got the question. I wanted to use this to close the loop on Commune. How are you guys different than other real estate investment groups?
Here it is. Good question. Okay, so there's really, I would say, 3 things that separate us from others. The first one, I'll start with the strategy. We have a unique strategy on how we do real estate. On our storage side, we are converting retail into storage. It's adaptive reuse. So we buy big box retail that goes vacant, Walmarts, Kmarts, Bed Bath & Beyonds, and we repurpose those into storage. It's not an easy thing to do. Like cities do not like doing that. It's very difficult to get a city on board. And because it doesn't, I mean, when you think about it, right, you got a retail space like a Kmart. That Kmart's going to create a lot of jobs.
Yep.
Brings in a lot of revenue for a city. When you convert it into storage, you don't need that many people to manage a storage facility, one person on site. And it doesn't bring in as much sales revenue or as much sales tax. So cities don't love that, right? And then you look at like the council members, there's not a lot of political gain in that as well. Like council members like going, we built housing or we created jobs. Like that's a good, mm-hmm. you know, political win there. So it's not easy to do. So we have a model on where we've figured out how to not only locate these distressed assets, but get cities on board to allow us to do it, which is it's a strategic advantage in itself. I would say on the multifamily side, we invest in California, which a lot of people will not go near because it is so difficult to do so. And we invest in the areas that are the most undersupplied, which means it's the most difficult to get new projects through. So we just by nature, what we do inside the real estate space is difficult. And we don't see a lot of competitors doing it the way we are. I would say what makes our group real different is most groups make money based on deploying capital, right? They raise as much as they can to get as much out into the market so that they can get their acquisition fee, they can get their management fees. Like that's how their incentive is built for them to make money. Our business is not done like that. Our business is basically me and three of my partners have the majority of our net worth in these projects passively. So when we're doing new deals, we're looking at it first and foremost, how is this going to affect our investment? How is this going to affect our family? And when we decide to move forward on a deal, then we bring investors alongside us to partner with us. You don't see a lot of groups like that. And yeah. So I would say those are probably the two separating factors. Maybe the third would be, I don't know if there's any other group with an ex-pro skateboarder and entrepreneur
has
four partners that are all financially minded, CFAs and CFPs. And you just don't see these two worlds collide. And I think how we end up going about projects, how we communicate to investors, it's a different experience because truthfully, like this group shouldn't exist. Like you never see this structure anywhere else. So I think we kind of have a unicorn of a team as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's well said. Man, I know we were coming up on the, probably past the time that I said that we'd have from you, but we can't not talk about city council. So I just want to hear
I
from
gave
you.
I have you scheduled for a full hour. So go as long as you'd like.
Love it. Well, let's hear about city council. Why add more to your plate? You have a family. So you have four kids, you said?
I have four kids. Yeah. 11, 9, 3, and 1.5. So right. It's busy. You know, we're in that tough life cycle. We're not sleeping a lot. But the reason why my wife was starting to talk about checking out other areas to live. And I did not want to do that. I love where we live. Like this is where I grew up. This is where my family is. I love this place.
Can I pause you? Where was she looking?
My wife really likes down south. My wife likes San Clemente, San Diego. Okay.
Gotcha.
She wanted to go down there. And okay. She has family down there. When we started St. Archer, we kind of, you know, expected that would end up being our home.
Yep.
But we didn't. And we've been here and I love it here. So basically she was kind of talking about, let's go check out other areas. I was like, no, why would you do that? And she started talking about like things that like she wishes our community had. And so I basically said, well, why don't we just create it? Like, let's just like be a part of the change. And she's like, yeah, what does that mean? I'm like, I don't know. And so she was like, well, try to think of ways in which you can get involved. So when I was doing that, some of the things I was thinking was one, I have a full-time business that I'm running, so I can't step away from this business. It has to be something I could do on the side. And two, I was trying to figure out where my skill set could actually be applied to benefit the community. And I started looking at what that would look like, and I felt like city council was kind of the perfect spot where it was part-time. It was, you know, by and large, land use designations and, you know, budgets and the local economy. I was like, this is like in my bag, you know? And so I decided I would run. And so I ran a campaign. I had no idea what I was doing. I treated it like a business. And it ended up working. I ended up getting elected and I just finished serving my first year. So I have 3 more years left on my 4-year term.
Come on. Congrats.
Yeah.
What have some unexpected challenges been with holding a position?
Um, I would say for me personally, I've had to adjust to the speed in which government moves at. It's very slow. It's really, really slow. So being somebody who's used to coming up with an idea and being able to get that idea into the market within 30 days, you know, I had to get used to adjusting that timeline. But I feel like it's a year in now. I've got a good grasp on it. And then I would say too, you know, it's interesting because you run a campaign and you have an idea and a vision and you have other people that are running against you that might have a different idea. And, you know, you get a certain amount of votes. The other people get a certain amount of votes. But when you get elected, you're now all of a sudden representing everyone. You know, you're not just representing your side. And so, you know, you have to learn that as well. Like, how do you represent everyone, even though what some of the people want to do is actually different than what you want to do? You know, I had to learn how to navigate through that.
Right. Well, you've accomplished so much and in so many different categories of life, professional athlete to entrepreneur, two different ways, government, very, very cool, very interesting. What do you want your legacy to be when you're done with this life? How do you want people to think of Mikey Taylor?
I think probably my legacy is probably going to be the kids. Like, you know, I think who my kids become is probably going to be a testament of, you know, the responsibility that my wife and I hold. So I think that's probably going to be a big one. You know, when people think of me, I don't know. I would say I hope that they think I really liked him. Like, I trusted him. He was always there. He was fun to be around. You know, I think that would be it. But more than anything, like, I want my kids to have all of the tools available to them. And then I want them to be able to go out and actually make an impact. Yeah. And if they do that well, I think from a legacy standpoint, I think my wife and I will be good.
Well said.
I like that answer. Yeah. Adam's a father of three, so I know he resonates.
Yeah, so look, you know how it is, man. You got these kids that you're responsible to build into adults. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's a huge responsibility, and
better lean into it.
Yep. So
there's no other alternative.
Yep, that's right.
Something that the owner of our company, Josh Sherrard, he talks about having a living legacy and a legacy. So obviously legacy after you're passed on, what are you going to leave behind? And then he asked people about a living legacy. And that's something I get really passionate about. What are you going to do while you're alive? How are you going to have fun with a legacy while you're living? And sometimes there are answers when we ask our clients, and the majority of time there isn't. And when Josh first asked me, I didn't have a good answer either. But yeah. It's definitely a good thing to think about. And like you said, raising up children to be good adults, great adults, and hopefully take on after mom and dad. So,
yeah. And I think too, like, another thing to think about is, if you don't know why you're here, you have no ability to manage if you're doing a good job or not. It's impossible without knowing your purpose. So I think it's easy for us to not answer that question because it's a difficult question.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, when I stopped skating, there was an identity crisis that I was not prepared for. And I had to spend time trying to answer these difficult questions that most of us push out for our entirety of our lives. And one of the big ones for me was, why am I here? What is the reason I am even here to do anything? Like, what is the point of this? And once I was able to answer that, it made it much easier to gauge if I was doing a good job or not, to help me make a decision of yes or no based on if it aligned in my purpose or not. It was really important to do. So I would recommend to anybody, spend time answering the question, who are you and why are you here? If you answer those correctly, they will change the rest of your life. It's really important to do so.
I 100% agree. And when you figure that out, then you can start setting goals.
Yep. That's otherwise, right.
Otherwise, they're just wishes. A goal
that's
is
right.
Something with a deadline.
Right. That's so, right. Somebody told me a long time ago, if you have a cup, right? If you have like a, just pretend this is like one of those red cups, right? If you have a cup, and you know that the purpose of the cup is to hold liquid, right? Then you can pour liquid in and know if this cup is doing its job or not, right? Mm-hmm. You poke holes in it, can't hold the liquid, it's not living its purpose. But without knowing if the purpose of a cup is to hold water, you have no ability to gauge anything at all. Mm-hmm. And it's the same way for us. Like you got to know what you're here to do, or you're just running around kind of like a, you know, chicken with its head cut off. It's like, what's the point?
I think awesome. that's a good spot to wrap it up. Yeah, I like that a lot. Adam, do you have any final questions before we stop recording?
I don't. This is Nugget Fest. People are going to pull a lot of good things out of this. Thank you, Mikey.
Heck yeah, I appreciate you guys.
Thank you, Mikey.
Thanks for listening to Navigate. If you're interested in learning more about Strategic Navigators, feel free to click on the link in the description.